Food price volatility, this extreme variability, swing, changes of prices, unfortunately accompanied by uncertainty, they represent a terrible threat for global food security and economic stability, especially in less developed countries. How serious is this situation today, and how serious is it going to be in the near future? Is there any remedy for this ill situation? We're very good at proposing remedies. To discuss these issues, we have invited a panel of distinguished speakers. But before, I should tell you that there is a small change in the program. Unfortunately, Gary Matthew, coordinator of National Coordination for Food Security 80, was not able to be with us today. But fortunately, Mr. Dudley Adolf agreed to step in. Thank you very much for making yourself available. Much appreciated. So let me introduce our first speaker. Daniel Gustafsson. Daniel Gustafsson is the director of the FAO Liaison Office for North America. He has been with FAO since 1994, first in Mozambique as an advisor within the Ministry of Agriculture, and then headed FAO's country offices in Nairobi, Kenya, and New Delhi, India. He has a BS and MSc degree from the University of Wisconsin and a PhD from the University of Maryland. Prior to joining FAO, he was the Program Director for Agriculture and Natural Resources at the University of Maryland's International Development Management Center. And from 1977 to 1988, worked in Brazil for the Inter-American Institute for Cooperation in Agriculture. I invite Dr. Gustafsson. The microphone is yours.
Thank you very much, Humberto. It's a real pleasure for me to be back at the conference here. Michelle, I was here in the first year. I hope to be here the other 2 years, but for kind of last-minute changes for other things that I had to fill in for, I wasn't able to make it. And it really is a pleasure to be here. I'm especially happy to be on this panel and to start out. And I think, to some extent, make kind of a bridge between this morning session and the speakers on my panel and a little bit of the rest of the afternoon, building a little bit on what often has been my role in FAO and elsewhere, kind of translating a lot of the work of FAO and others in kind of what it means in terms of policy or dialogue and so on in the countries where we work. And I thought it would be interesting to go over a little bit as kind of an introductory way, kind of what we know about the impact of high and volatile prices on food and nutrition security, and a lot of which is known. How we get to that point is an interesting story, and there's also a lot that isn't quite so clear and that is somewhat controversial, and I thought that would be helpful to go into that also. So just to recap a little bit, and a lot of this we went over this morning, we know that soaring food prices have had a devastating impact on millions of families and their livelihoods at the household level, at the country level, and sort of globally. This comes out of a long period of decline with low prices that led to lack of investment. Other reasons also, as Bob Thompson mentioned this morning, led to lower investment. Also volatility in the system in developing countries for a long time that has been a disincentive for investment, especially for small farmers, smallholders, and agroecologically poor areas. We know, of course, that higher agricultural prices can also be a good thing and lead to higher farm incomes, and for farm incomes, more employment, especially for rural landless laborers, and higher wages. And since we have about three-fifths, let's say, of the world's poor work directly in agriculture, another one-fifth in non-farm rural employment, you would think, and to some extent it's true, that higher prices would be good for that. And of course, we've also seen how they are bad for those vulnerable. You know, kind of looking at what what the story is. So the questions really, I think, to start out this session would be, you know, we know that high prices create winners and losers, but who are they? And just very briefly to go over those some of those factors and then look at what the real impact has been, which is a more complicated story. And then look at kind of within that what we don't know very well and why we may not know that so well. And then since, as a number of speakers have pointed out this morning, since high prices and volatility will continue, maybe get worse, what does the recent experience since 2007 and 8, what does that tell us about where we're going in the future? So certainly this is what we would all expect, that the greater the vulnerability, the greater the impact of this volatility and higher prices. This, of course, is true both for families and households and also for countries. And in general, price increases were banned both for food security and for poverty in the short term, and we hope that in the long term there may be some positive impacts. We'll get to that in a little while. But as has been pointed out this morning a couple of times, really the reason that the negative impact has been so devastating for millions has been that the poor spend a disproportionate amount of their income on food and within that on staples. On the average, about 70% of expenditures of the poorest fifth, the poorest 20% of households, goes to food. So what about farm families? And here, often people outside of the sector, at least, look at the difference or think in terms of subsistence versus commercial producers. But really what we need to look at are the net buyers and the net food sellers. And, of course, the poorest farm households tend to be, or rural households and farm households tend to be net buyers of food. So if you look at it, just a couple of countries, in Guatemala, the bottom fifth of households earns a little over half of their income from agriculture wages. Only about a third of those are net sellers. Bangladesh, only about 12% are net sellers of that larger group. And in Malawi, 94% are net buyers. So most of that poorest category of rural families, farm families, are in fact spending, are buying more food than they are selling. And they are probably doing both, but that's really where the impact comes from. We know that this has a short-term impact because of vulnerabilities and how they cope, but depending on the type of shock of which prices are one, droughts are another, and so on, other civil unrest or whatever it might be, flooding, can have really a devastating long-term impact. And there's a lot of evidence of this in terms of even tracking, let's say, children's height or adults' height based on what year they were born and the rainfall and so on. So that we know that shocks of any nature can have a really long-term impact on because of nutrition impacts over the long term. Okay, so that's it for households. This is pretty well understood and well documented. For countries, the big change there was how well countries were able to cushion domestic prices from the large price swings internationally. And Asia did a very good job in this, especially India and China, which of course are huge countries with huge portions, let's say, of the total production and consumption. Africa was not able to do this, so the impact, needless to say, in Africa was much greater than it was in Asia. However, if you look, I've got a couple of slides from my colleague David Daw, who is an economist in our Bangkok regional office, had been working in headquarters for a few years and is back now in Asia. This shows the index of domestic real prices, in other words, adjusting for inflation, all starting at 100 in 2007, and you can see what happened to domestic prices over that period. So domestic prices did not rise in many cases, and we'll look at a couple other examples to the same extent that international prices did, but nevertheless, they did go up a lot over that period, came down, and then are trending up again in from 2010. If you look, however, at a country like China, and if you look at rice prices, again, these are real prices. The dark blue line is the domestic price of rice, and the dotted line is the world price. And you can see that rice prices in China up to November 2008 really were remarkably stable. A similar graph on this that looks at soybeans that has a different policy regime in China, the domestic price of soybeans goes up along with global price, but for China, not the case. If you look at kind of all domestic prices for which David Dahl, in this case, could get a price series, the dark black line is the world price, again, adjusted for inflation, of rice from 2007 to 2010, and it would be, you know, up about at the ceiling if we had that 305 peak. But if you look at the dark blue line, would be the domestic prices for the countries which we can track them, which is a lot. And then if you would weigh those countries by how large their share is of consumption, where India and China, for example, would have even more weight, of course, then that impact is even lower. I think it's important to point out here that even at that lowest dotted line, we still have an increase of more than 20%, which is a significant thing, especially if you are in that bottom group of households and spending a lot of your income on staples. Okay, so the impact then of high prices, just in summary, we know that price transmission, this transmission of, let's say, the global prices to the domestic, was a lot less domestically than what we see in, for example, the FAO price index, which is index of international prices. But it was rapid and it was substantial. Some countries were able to cushion this quite well, others were not. Those that were able to cushion it had much less impact. Generally, farm prices increased along, this would be prices to farmers, increased wherever retail prices increased, and the supply response, if not immediately in the first year or the next year, actually were quite good. On the other hand, no question on this one, the most vulnerable really did suffer a great deal, both in terms of countries and in terms of households, and just kind of in a nutshell, those that had low dietary diversification, both countries and households, where you are essentially spending most of your consumption expenditures on staples, had a lot more impact than, as we talked about this morning in some of the sessions, in what you can make, different choices you have, and the substitution, and so on. Okay, so far so good, and this is all pretty straightforward. What is less straightforward has been the impact in terms of global numbers. And this gets to be really quite a complicated story and remains, let's say, a work in progress and a very interesting one, I think. So FAO's number, the estimate of chronically undernourished, it comes out generally every year in one of the flagship publications that David Hallow mentioned this morning, another one called State of Food Insecurity, comes out in October. And for example, the 925 million number that was used in one of the presentations comes from that, only looks at calories, dietary energy supply. It doesn't look at other kinds of malnutrition. And it is based on national level data and the minimum number of variables possible, so you can make this calculation for all the countries more or less every year. And the way that it's calculated has a lot of advantages to it for that reason. It also has a lot of disadvantages, and it is being reviewed at the moment. And in fact, the next SOFI comes out on Monday and will not have a number for this year because of the methodological improvements and changes, and they felt it was just better to come out later. It also doesn't pick up very well the issues of access. It's much better at picking up issues of availability, and it doesn't really pick up ever improvements in the safety nets. The other way of looking at this is really through simulations that came out a lot after 2008, and looking at what would happen with an increase in food prices and the impact on poverty and so on. And these are, I think, exceptionally good, but are limited, and you have kind of a fragmented view as a review of this that came out of what's called the high-level panel of experts of the Committee on Food Security, kind of an external group, that looked really at kind of a criticism of the fragmented view that we have of that. There are other ways of looking at this that I'm sure many of you will have seen. One of those is from the Poverty Action Lab in an article that caused a lot of got a lot of attention on, you know, if there are more than 1 billion hungry in the world. But what if the experts are wrong on this? This was in the in foreign policy. And what they did is look at and see the decisions that poor households actually made, what happens, what you do, what they say when you ask them, and so on. And there's a similar thing from one of Mark Rosemann's colleagues at IFPI, Derek Hitty, on looking at the Gallup World Poll that shows that if you ask people how they are doing, it looked like food security actually declined. Both of these don't say that there wasn't a problem, but do in fact call attention to a number of things, including the fact that in 2008 in particular, India and China, a big part of the global problem, didn't in fact suffer the same way that it may have looked. This leads me, in kind of a personal way, to look at a really good illustration of all that we don't know, which is the impact of prices and volatility, is that we don't understand really a huge amount about what's going on with food security in India, which is a big piece of the global food security and hunger puzzle. Very fast-growing economy, large malnourished population, outstanding household surveys through the National Sample Survey Organization, been going on for a long time. And if you look at those data, they show a decline in per capita calorie consumption over the last 25 years of about 10%, which is kind of remarkable and difficult to understand how that could be. And it is in fact a puzzle, even among those who are exceptionally good at analyzing this kind of thing. If you look at the way the FAO, in its more kind of simplistic, straightforward national cereal balance way, it does show a slight increase in per capita calorie consumption, but not very much over that period. So there are a number of explanations for what might come out of, what might explain this, including preferences for other goods. Angus Deaton and John Drez have an interesting suggestion, perhaps not more than a suggestion, that the decline in calorie requirements because of less physical labor and better transportation and so on would lead to a lowering of calorie requirements. Lisa Smith, in a draft paper, at least so far, looks at the possibility of underreporting of meals consumed outside the home, not just like at restaurants and so on, but even what employers would give and the difficulty in doing that. And in general, it's just very difficult, even with outstanding household surveys, to come up with a good explanation across India on what is going on with calorie consumption. And without that, looking at what the impact of volatility and high prices would be, of course, becomes much more murky. On the other hand, I think in just conclusion, looking at the long term, in spite of this ongoing puzzle of what the impact at kind of the global level would be, and even what's going on in a place like India or elsewhere, we are hopeful that if volatility is not so extreme, which of course is a damper on many things, that the high prices that have been observed and are likely to continue for some time will have a positive impact in stimulating investment and policies and more infrastructure and credit and education and so on that a number of the speakers this morning looked at. This is a very big if. We aren't sure that this is, of course, going to happen. But even let's say, the presence of the McGill conference now in its fourth year, I think, is testimony to the attention that food security is getting that it probably would not have gotten some years ago, even though the number of the world's hungry prior to 2007 was still in the 850 million range or something along that in that range, and it was not getting the attention from policymakers and donors and government ministers of finance that we are seeing today. So in spite of this, we hope that we would see, in spite of the short-term impact that is largely negative, we hope that in the long term it would in fact stimulate these policy and investment changes. Thank you very much.